Thank you very much. One talks about the question of minorities in terms of the issues that we're discussing this evening. And I think that we can safely say tonight that between Sid and Eliseo and myself, that we are a pretty sound majority in this country, particularly if we include that other sector of our society so often called the white niggers, the Appalachians. But the minorities issue, in a larger sense, is one that indicates the kind of arrogance that has kept the air pollution issue what it is in our country. The minorities issue is not only a concern for the whole problem of whether one is black or red or brown or yellow in this society, but it is also a concern for the larger problem of a definition of maturity in this country. And when I speak of a definition of maturity, I'm speaking to a large extent of whether we as black people, brown people, or if you will, the totality of the Rainbow Coalition are ever taken seriously as a constituency in America. Whether in fact, in terms of the way America looks at problems, the racism that exists because we are always just a horde of wards of the state, or dependents, or disadvantaged people, or any of the other racist definitions that we want to give black, brown, yellow, and red Americans, but are never considered a part of the pluralism that in fact must go into the interacting dynamics of the nation itself. Given that particular reality, we understand the whole pollution issue in terms of the question economically of scarcities in our society. For rather than define the abundance and resources of our nation in terms of its abundance, we define the resources of the nation in terms of those things you can get if you can play the game effectively and if you can gamble with the right stakes in mind. If you can put up a good poker hand, you can play the game. This means, of course, that good education, decent standard housing, and decent health all becomes a part of the scarcities in our society. And because those things become a part of the scarcities, it is very easy to see the role of technology as preempting the larger forces of economic growth in our society. So it is that we can have a $1 trillion or more economy and yet have 40 million people who live below the poverty standard. So it is that 1.6% of our population controls absolutely 26% of our wealth, while 5.4% of the population struggles to secure about 20% of the population struggles to secure about 5.4% of the wage income. Now, I think you can begin to understand what these contradictions mean. For instance, how are we to look at the term that has come to mean so much in relationship to the growth of the construction industry, the term air rights? How are we to look at these air rights when we begin to understand that the top 400 construction industries in this country were able to amass about $33.25 billion in profits this past year. That 44 of these 400 companies were able to amass about 57% of the volume of construction of the nation, and that this amount equaled the total amount of construction done in 1965. You see, it's very easy to create a Redbud reservation when you can do things like that. It's very easy to create a Robert Taylor Holmes when you can understand air rights in that particular manner. It's very easy to create an uptown and a day labor, contract labor situation, and the totality of contract life when one lives in a home owned by the contractors that create the contract labor system. It's very easy to see the reason for combined insurance company and the whole syndrome of the Stone Brandel situation in the city of Chicago when you understand this. It is the truth tonight that we could take the agricultural export income of our state, the agricultural export income of this state, and provide an additional $1,004 for every hunger family in the state of Illinois. It is the truth tonight that there are 15 counties in the state of Illinois where more than 23% of the population of families are hunger families. It is the truth tonight that 9 of every 11 counties reporting in the southern end of the state of Illinois below this particular location, 9 of every 11 of those counties report more deaths than births at the end of each year. It is the truth tonight that the $2.8 billion manufactured export income that is secured in Illinois is more than enough to handle all of the hunger problems and all of the problems of poverty in this state, and at least one quarter of the hunger and poverty families of the nation itself. But when one begins to relate that the whole technostructure that Kenneth Galbraith spoke of is the, in fact, structure that creates and determines decisions in the nation, it is no wonder that a man like Arthur Burns can talk about a $7 billion surplus as a bookkeeping entry, when in fact $7 billion is all of the money we need to grossly alleviate the whole problem of poverty. For instance, we could take that $7 billion and in applying it to the 1.2 million families with average incomes of $327 a year, remove the specter of poverty for them and set their incomes at a level approximating that of the low standard budget for income for the Bureau of Labor Standards. We could do that tonight, you see. But because we are able to take the Litton Industries and allow them to develop their systems analysis program to an extent where they contribute towards the whole foreign policy that we emit towards the Greek colonels, and because we are able to allow 44 construction industries to amass something in the neighborhood of 57% of the total construction volume of the nation, we allow this to exist. Now again, until minorities are so organized that they become majorities by linking up nationally, and until we have decent white students and white faculty members who will no longer submit themselves to the Institute of Defense Analysis and will no longer submit themselves to the Action and Planning Council for Thailand, and will no longer submit themselves to the kind of research for the destruction of the Mekong and the destruction of other programs for men, who will no longer submit themselves to the Army Corps of Engineers so that that Corps of Engineers floods the Rosebud Reservation and floods other resources in our country for the Native Americans and for the Mexican Americans and for the Puerto Ricans of our country, until that exists, you see. Then when they call us minorities, they are not simply talking about people in terms of numbers, they are talking about a status of life that indicates that one's life will be one of digesting deprivation and poverty and ingesting the kind of hunger and utter desperation that in fact exists for most of us at the present time. We must make up our minds on this campus that we will organize link-ups with the Mexican-American farm workers and with the Native American persons in our particular state to, in fact, begin to set in motion a type of organization that can not only stop the machinery of this country from destroying human life, but can, in fact, politically begin to influence foreign policy, influence domestic policy, yes, and if need be, as we understand the situation that is developing in Southeast Asia, also influence foreign policy. We must begin to see that the Silent Spring is about us, and it screams about the kind of utter desperation that man has allowed himself to be submitted to as a result of the extremely poor toilet training of industry itself. And that until industry is willing to toilet train itself in terms of trying to deal with the problems of pollution, and until industry is willing also to train itself in terms of dealing with the problem of the underemployed and the unemployed in our society, we will still be a part of the victims of the Silent Spring. What we are talking about this evening as minorities is how we become a significant constituency in this society to express ourselves and articulate our aims not only in terms of the cultural manifestations of our art, of our music, and of our expressions of ourselves and our determination to define ourselves, but also how we can get educational institutions and other institutions of our society, particularly the financial institutions, to recognize the basically destructive policy involved in one bank holding companies accounting for about 1% of the banking industry in this country, yet hold 43% of the banking assets of the nation, and that 1% of the farms in this country, 1% of them, produce 25% of the product and 65% of the vegetables and 43% of the fruits that exist in this country. Until we understand that, then in fact we will still be minorities. Indeed, we will still be minor figures unable to relate and significantly move on this society. Earth Day is not a romance. It should not be taken as some kind of trippingly light, fantastic kind of Aeolian feel in which we create for ourselves dreams of what tomorrow ought to be. We must see Earth Day as, in fact, the re-expression of the terms of the Bible that the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, and that as the words of Psalm 8 tells us, he gave man, the Native American man, the man in the Basuta land, the man in Botswana, the man in the Sahara and the Sudan, man in Mississippi and Alabama, man in uptown in Chicago, man in the ghettos of Southside and Westside Chicago. He gave man dominion, or the sharing stewardship over those resources, and no technology and no technostructure has a right to redetermine that fact. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Eliseo Medina. He is a member of the United Farm Workers and of also the Easter coordinator of the Boycott Grape Committee. I give you Eliseo Medina.
You know, I was invited to come here and talk about pollution. You know, when I received the invitation, I thought about all the teach-ins, all the conferences, where the PhDs and the politicians get up and talk, and talk, and talk, and talk some more about the problems, and then they go to Washington. Then they go to their nice homes and talk about it some more and write books. Well, I'm here to talk too. But I'm not here to tell you about what's going to happen to the earth in 20 or 30 years. I'm here to talk to you about what's happening now. Now, not tomorrow. You can never be sure that tomorrow is going to come. In the state of California today, they are dumping 100 million tons of pesticides every year. These pesticides are seeping into the soil, into the earth, into the water, so that none of us are free from those pesticides today. And Richard Nixon went to Chicago and had a big conference on pollution. He went up there and told us all the good things he's going to do to end pollution, how the government is going to meet the challenge. Well, I stand here and accuse Richard Nixon of being a hypocrite. And I stand here and accuse Richard Nixon of being full of BS. You know something? If Richard Nixon was really serious about pollution, he would tell the steel mills, either you stop pollution and get in line, or we'll make you get in line. Richard Nixon was really serious about stopping pollution. He would stop Spiro Agnew from talking. You know, I've heard all these politicians and all these scientists, they're all talking about what's going to happen to the Earth. 2 years ago, or a year ago, the Food and Drug Administration stopped several carloads or several shipments of coho salmon from Lake Michigan because it was too full of DDT for human consumption. I've heard then how they had a big conference in Chicago. All the five governors around Lake Michigan came together to discuss pollution. The first thing they did, they took a picture of themselves drinking water from off Lake Michigan from a pitcher. And they whitewashed the entire thing. You want to know why? You know that the government stopped the sale of cyclamates because they found it causes cancer, or maybe it causes cancer. And pesticides that are proven that approximately 80,000 to 100,000 people in the United States today are suffering from pesticide poisoning, and of 800 to 1,000 people in the United States are dying each year from pesticide poisoning. In California, 150 to 200 farm workers are dying every year from pesticide poisoning. They will never stop that. You know why? Because cyclamates, it's a little thing. So the Food and Drug Administration wants you to make you think that they're doing their job. But when they start tackling pesticides, you're talking about Dow Chemical Company, Shell Company, Standard Oil Company, these huge companies, multi-million dollar industries that are bringing in a lot of money to the government so that they will never stop the use of pesticides unless we make them do so. Because we're talking about money. And all these guys happen to be the ones that are donating to Richard Nixon's campaign. So that they're not going to do a darn thing. You know, last year, Secretary of Health and Education and Welfare, Finch, said that if they stopped the use of DDT today, it would take up to 20 years for the environment to cleanse itself. So what does he do? He says, Walt Bennett in 1973. In California, where we are trying to organize ourselves to have some power, to determine our own lives, a lot of the farm workers are working in the fields where they have just sprayed parathion, melathion, TEP. And many of them are suffering from pesticide symptoms. You know, they're losing their hair, fingernails, their skin is turning yellow. They're developing lung cancer. Many of them are dying, but they don't know why. They think it's probably something that they ate that's wrong. They think that the sun is too hot. 2 months ago, they conducted a study on farm worker children, and they found that more than half of them are suffering from pesticide poisoning. And because the growers don't care, we have a co-op clinic in California. And we found out through our clinic that these workers were suffering from pesticide poisoning. So we went to the Kern County Agricultural Commissioner, who is in charge of seeing that all pesticides are registered. Who's going to apply it? How are they going to apply it? How toxic is it? How long before it's safe for the workers to go into the fields? But there's a catch. the laws that says that you have to register with the Kern County Agricultural Commission only apply to professional pesticide applicator companies. In other words, if a grower wants to do his own spraying, he doesn't have to register. And the companies are saying that they're going to comply with federal and state regulations, which are non-existent. And where they are, they're never enforced. So we went to the Kern County Agricultural Commission and we said, look, we want to see the records of what is being applied in the fields. How toxic is it? This is supposed to be public information. Well, the guy says, I can't do it today. You'll have to come back tomorrow. So the next day came and he says, you'll have to come back tomorrow. And the third day he says, well, you have to come back tomorrow. We'll have it for you for sure. This was around 11 o'clock in the morning. By 1 p.m., there was an injunction prohibiting the Kern County Agricultural Commissioner from showing those records to the union. Public records, we couldn't see them. So we went to court to appeal the injunction. And the judge said, it is true that pesticides, if improperly applied, can be very dangerous. But all the pesticide industries have trade secrets, just like Coca-Cola. And that if we reveal what these records contain, it might endanger the cooperation existing between the agriculture and the chemical industry. So that then they made it a permanent injunction against our seeing those records. And that's where it stands today. We cannot even see public records of what we're being poisoned with. 5 years ago in Delano, California, the town where the farm worker strike is, the city has been sending out once a year notices to all the families in Delano telling them not to give babies that are 1 year or younger water to drink from the city wells because of high concentrate of nitrates. See, all the pesticides, when they dump them on the earth, they seep into the wells so that the children can no longer drink that water because it's dangerous and they can die from it. But still, they refuse to see it. They refuse to do anything about it. And when the government tells you that they're going to ban DDT, do not be fooled. So what if they ban DDT? There's still aldrin, dieldrin, andrin, parathion, malathion, tep, kelthane, and 100 others that will never be banned. But they are doing to you what we call in Mexico, tapándole el ojo al macho. That means, you know, that they're just whitewashing the entire thing to make you think that they're really protecting you. The Food and Drug Administration say that they're not testing everything and every produce and every piece of fruit. They check sporadically, like maybe once or twice every year, they check a particular product and they take the word of the growers and they take the word of the chemical companies that there's no pesticides. They're not doing their job. They're trying to whitewash the entire issue. And they got what they call tolerance levels. How ridiculous can it get? You know, they're telling you that it's okay for you to eat a little bit of poison, but it's not okay for you to eat a lot of poison. The government says that 5 parts per million of DDT is more than any human being should take. But it's a fact that each and every one of you here today has more than 10 parts per million of DDT in your bodies. You are not fit to eat. If you were going to be sold as meat, you wouldn't make the grade. You are being poisoned. We are being poisoned. Now let me tell you what we're doing. We're tired of talking. And the government will never do anything to protect the people. Now here's what we're doing to protect this. I've got here a copy of a contract that we signed 2 weeks ago with 3 table grape growers in the state of California. Let me read you 3 clauses from this contract. Company and the United Farm Workers Organizing Committee recognize the need to protect and conserve human life, water, soil, and vegetation. Economic poisons, when used incorrectly by a grower in agriculture on any crop, could be harmful to farm workers and to consumers, disrupt the earth's ecology, and do not properly serve the farmers. In the hope of developing, with the help of federal, state, and university consultants, new imaginative and creative approaches to the problem of conserving our natural resources, and in hope of taking progressive steps to protect the health of farm workers and consumers. Company and union agree that the subject of economic poisons is necessary and desirable subject for this collective bargaining agreement. Company and union agree as follows. Union shall cause to be formed a health and safety committee comprised of workers' representatives. Members of the committee shall have free access to all records concerning the use of economic poisons. The committee shall participate in the formulation of rules and practices relating to the health and safety of workers, including, but not limited to, the following: use of economic poisons, the use of garments, materials, tools, and equipment, as they may affect the health and safety of the workers, and sanitation conditions. Section B, DDT, aldrin, dieldrin, endrin, parathion, TEP, and other economic poisons which are extremely dangerous to farm workers, consumers, and the environment shall not be used. This is the only place in the United States where poisons are being banned. In every new contract that we're negotiating, we're banning these pesticides. And under this contract, we have power to ban any and all other pesticides that are found to be dangerous. But we have to do that ourselves because the government is not going to do it. They don't give a damn if our people are being poisoned. You know, they're dying, and the government is just listing them off as more casualties. And here, you know, the government sits talking about our advanced technology, how we're so much more advanced than any other nation in the world. All that means is that we are going to die first. And they are telling us, you know, about a great American dream and a great society. There can be no American dream or no great society for the poor of this country unless we organize ourselves and get set to fight for our rights. You know, we know the government is not going to do it for us. We don't have money, political power, so they don't care about us. And the politician's job is to go to Congress and compromise with our lives, and then they don't have to live with the decisions that they make. The church is not going to do it for us. They're talking about how up in heaven there's enough bread and enough food for everybody. Try telling that to your child someday, not to cry. Don't be hungry. Up in heaven there's enough for everybody. And they're telling us that the meek shall inherit the earth. We say, yeah, we know that. The question is when? We are talking about now. And they are too concerned with our spiritual needs. And thinking and praying to God is a rich man's luxury. When you're hungry and when you're starving, you don't have time to start praying to God. You're thinking first, how are you going to feed your children? How are you going to stop them from crying? For too many years, the poor, the Mexicans, black people, and everybody else have had somebody else speaking for us. But we're saying, no more. We can speak for ourselves. We know where we're going and we know what we need. And for closing, I'll just refer to a question that was put to Emiliano Zapata, who was one of the greatest revolutionary heroes in Mexico. He was a farm worker. He was born in Aniquilco. And he gave up his land and he went and fought in the revolution. His theme was pan, tierra y libertad, bread, land, and freedom. And he was fighting so that all the poor would no longer be slaves. We would all have enough bread. We would all have a piece of land. We would all be free to be human beings once again. So they asked him whether he was not afraid of dying, of being assassinated. So Emiliano answered, "It is much better to die on your feet than to live on your knees." Farm workers have lived on their knees long enough. Poor people have lived on their knees long enough. We all know that we have to die. And as I stand here today, I tell you that I know I'm gonna die. But if we're gonna die, let it be fighting so that our children will not inherit the same kind of life that we've had. We're gonna die, let us die. But let us die fighting for an ideal rather than to live selling out. Thank you.
Next speaker is Sid Mean from the Native Americans. Sid Mean.
That's the Native American Committee of Chicago. We have some of our membership here tonight. I'd like them to stand up and let the people know we're here. Would you stand up? Sometime back, a couple months ago, the Native American Committee of Chicago went to a teaching on pollution at Northwestern University. Unfortunately, we were not invited. We went feeling that we are experts on pollution because we feel we've been the most polluted in this country. And we talked about the pollution of Native American lands, religions, and minds. And I hope that tonight you can gain some wisdom from some of the things that I'm going to relate to you about our experiences, our historical experiences, in dealing with the United States government, in dealing with its various agencies, those very agencies that have a lot of responsibility for cleaning the air and the water. If you look at our land, you'll see that it is diminished quite extensively since 1492. If you look at us, you'll see that what has happened historically is that a government that has attempted to take control of us has herded us rather than guided us. And I wonder if that isn't what's happening to a lot more of us today, that even on university campuses, we may be herded. A lot of people talk about such men as Adolf Hitler and what he and his constituency did to the Jewish population of Germany and other countries. What about President Andrew Jackson and other presidents in this country and the Native Americans? You see very similar situations, but somehow a lot of this material has been excluded from the history books. We find that the educational system, in a sense, has been polluted. I'd like to talk a little more specifically about the Commonwealth Edison of the Native Americans, which is the Bureau of Indian Affairs. We find that the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Department of the Interior tend to be the largest polluters of bullshit in this country as far as the Native American is concerned. And that's an expansion on what my predecessor said. We find that the Bureau of Indian Affairs today has one bureaucrat for every 18 Native Americans. It reminds me of a little story where an old tribal chairman was going to see the commissioner, and he was sitting in his office with some of his fellow tribesmen, and he was talking to the commissioner, and he said, "You know, there's something that really puzzles me." He said, "I come from my reservation where there's a agency, and there I talk with the Great White Father, and then I go to my area office, and there's another Great White Father, and now I come here to Washington, and you are here, and there's these other Great White Fathers with you." He says, "What puzzles me is, how come we're in such poor shape if we have so many fathers to take care of us?" I would hope that government agencies, in their fight against pollution, would not follow the route of the agencies like the Bureau of Indian Affairs, who have a tendency to set up advisory councils. I would hope that President Nixon, you know, goes a long ways further than what has been happening to us. We have found advisory councils to be nothing more than tokenism. They're a way of keeping self-control away from our land. In the area of pollution, one of our tribesmen from the state of Washington not too long ago, maybe you read about it in the paper, his name is James Jackson, the Quinault tribe, closed down the beaches that were that was land which his tribe owned because so many people were polluting it. And I think it's quite possible that this kind of a trend may continue as far as Native Americans are concerned. The land is the only real possession of the Native American. You know, it has been our life. Our relationship to our land is, in a sense, a religious relationship. The land and its resources, in effect, are our church. And yet, some years back, quite a number of missionaries came onto our land and told us, you know, we were savages, told us that our religion was wrong. We believe in a great spirit, in a creator, but we were told that we were wrong, that we did not follow the right rituals. And in effect, the church has been one of the greatest polluters of the Native Americans. At one time, the churches literally operated the reservations. They set up their mission schools. They taught polluted education. They told us to change our dress, to cut our hair, not to speak our native language. In a sense, they were a Bureau of Indian Affairs. What I think is happening among Native Americans is that in looking back over our history and the relationship we've had with government agencies, such as the BIA, an extension out of the presidential office, that we find if we get into the system, the whole damn thing is polluted. So why should we get in? So what a lot of my Native American brothers are talking about is a renewing of the relationship which existed at one time in this country, and that is recognizing Native American land as sovereign. States have sovereignty, you know, counties, cities have sovereignty. Why can't Indian land be sovereign? We don't want to get into a system that is completely polluted. It would be ridiculous. And in that sense, we would look for new treaties. Our old treaties were broken, one right after the other. Promises that have not been kept. But we're thinking about new treaties, and that's what the people on places like Alcatraz and Fort Lawton are talking about. Changing the situation from where our land is being taken away from us to even taking some back. And in the cities, a lot of my Native American brothers are talking about setting up things such as embassies. And we're talking about that very seriously. Find that as our numbers grow, our alienation increases. We haven't found the support, you know, that we've been looking for. The majority of the people in this country, we've been the most invisible of the invisible. And we've reached the point where if it's going to take raising hell to do it, that's what we're going to do. Recently, some of my brothers and sisters from the Native American Committee demonstrated at the BIA office in Chicago, where you have a situation where there is a BIA office which is focused on the reservation. It isn't focused on Native American people. It's focused on our land. They want it. So what that means is the urban Indian in places like Chicago has not been allocated 1 cent from the Bureau of the Budget to the Bureau of Indian Affairs. So we've gone there to look for a response, the response being to either fulfill a responsibility or get the hell out. And in doing so, 23 of my brothers and sisters were arrested for, believe it or not, trespassing in our office. Now, if that isn't bullshit, I don't know what is. Our statistics are, you know, among the lowest in the country. We're 0.5% of the population. In order to do the things we're talking about doing, which we think we have a right to do, and I hope you recognize those rights, We're going to need your support. We aren't going to wait for it. We hope you'll realize what our situation is, what all of our situation is. Our infant mortality rate is 3 times the national average. Average lifespan is 44 years. The national average is 64 years. Yearly income, Native American is $1,500. It's the average. It's half the national poverty level. When you consider the amount of money that's spent in Vietnam every day against what that money could do, you know, to just demonstrate to the Native American the concern of a country for its first inhabitants. You see a very disastrous foreign policy. You see a lot of benefits that are owed that have not been received. And this is the kind of the pollution that concerns us. It's the pollution of the entire system of this country, of our institutions. Thank you.
Now I'll open for any questions from the audience. There are mics back in the back if you can use those, please. It's in the center section.
I have one question for Mr. Riddick first. He mentioned that all the minorities, and I take it the non-white minorities primarily, are going to have to get together, you know, if we're going to get about self-determination. You know, I agree with that, and Native American agrees with that wholeheartedly. But we agree with it on the basis of equal representation and equal voice. And we've had a hassle with, you know, other black organizations. So I'll put that in terms of a comment. I like to relate too. I'll take this opportunity to relate to what Sidney Bean has said. Our whole thing, the Native American movement across this country, is self-determination. Self-determination against pollution, you know. And he's saying the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and he's saying the United States government. Well, I'm saying the white society, because that's who the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the United States government is, you know. And we're about it, and we're going to take it. Native American Committee is an action-oriented, community-based organization. And we're in conjunction with 6 other cities across the country who are also action organizations. And we've taken some definite stance in terms of actions against the Bureau, you know, to prevent further pollution of our lands. Like in the Taos Indian people lost their land, their lake, Blue Lake, because the tourist people wanted to come and fish. They put fish in that land so that white people can come there and fish in it, you know, not realizing that that land is sacred. You know, so in effect, what they did was pollute that lake. You know, so we're about not allowing any more forms of pollution to hit us on lands or in our ways of thinking, our culture, or anything else. And I'd like to mention, too, that because of our stand against pollution, we've been arrested. And Sidney mentioned that. And there are 6 other cities that have been arrested, totaling 93 people. And we're being prosecuted by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. So we've come up with the American Indian Defense Fund, which would include communications to the reservations and to the people on the reservations to protect our land. And if necessary, we'll have to defend our land from any forms of pollution. So if any people is interested in supporting, you know, a stand against pollution, then they can address donations to the Native American Committee, 1630 West Wilson, care of the Native American Committee, it's American Indian Defense Fund. Also, I'd like to mention that if the white people, when they first came to this country, if they took notice of our culture, they wouldn't have this pollution problem.
I simply want to respond that I agree wholeheartedly. I recognize the extent to which black organizations frequently, because of being hung up in their own problems and being thoroughly brainwashed and again polluted by white society, have felt that no one could lead the movement but themselves. I think it's right that the Native Americans, the Mexican Americans, and others have full equal representation and, in fact, have their equity with reference to the totality of society. I think sometimes when we say equal, we make a mistake for the simple reason that the understanding of equal that comes out of our white society indicates a kind of sameness that is impossible. When we talk about equity, it perhaps means that the Native Americans and the Mexican Americans, the Appalachian whites, will, in terms of quantity, need more. But in terms of quality and everything like that, need at least the basic right to express and the basic self-determination goals, which they themselves define as important and significant to them at a given time. And we do not need to hold hands with them on that. We need to lock arms, and if necessary, in going to jail or whatever is required, stand by them, because this is where it is at. And it is not a question of charity in so doing, it is an issue of survival.
Mr. Medina, I believe, who did you say you made that contract with, and how did you get it to be so all-inclusive that you can ban any pesticides that you decide that are harmful from now on?
I hope that I understood your question right. Unfortunately, the sound is not too good. Did you ask when this contract was signed, with whom, and how we determined what pesticides were harmful?
How you made the contract all-inclusive so that from now on, I believe you said that you could ban whatever pesticides.
I see, okay. Well, in this country, as we all know, the only thing that rules is power. Now, the growers have power and they will not listen to us until we have power at least equal to what they've got. The great boycott for us has been our power, consumer power. We have, through the great boycott, made the growers lose approximately $30 to $40 million in grapes that they have not sold. The grapes that have been sold have sold at 50 cents to a dollar less per box than the previous year. In Illinois alone, grape sales are down by 44%. So that when this guy starts hurting, you know, they're like the government. They don't think with their minds or with their hearts. They think with a wallet. And when you start squeezing that wallet, boy, watch them scream and yell. And then they're in a position where you can start saying, okay, man, this is what we're going to do. Last year, we had 11 growers that were negotiating a contract with the union. But they said, oh, no, there's nothing wrong with pesticides. You know, they're great. You know, after all, that's why we have so much food. And we said, no, you know, we have the proof. Here are the statistics of people dying from pesticides. We showed them with a little girl had stuck her fingers into a can of parathion and put them into her mouth and immediately going into convulsions and dying within 20 minutes. And they refused to see this. They said they would just go along with federal regulations, which, as I said before, are non-existent. So we waited an entire year. We wouldn't sign a contract with them without this clause. This year, you know, they've lost so much money that they just wanted to settle. And we said, look, this is the conditions. We will not compromise with our people's lives. So that this is what you have to do. So that we ban six different kinds of pesticides. And every contract we're signing, we're banning them. So that support for the great boycott is also support for a policy against pesticides and an irresponsible government that doesn't do anything about the lives of its people.
Are there any further questions? Yes.
I frequently said that, somewhat facetiously, but not hopefully too facetiously, that panthers arise when there are jungles. We live in jungles. All of us as black people are black panthers.
You know, for our part, you know, I've seen and I've heard many people that are bopping around demonstrating against the war and talking about peace. But if you cannot understand the kind of repression that the Panthers are going through, and if you cannot understand that we can have to stand together, then you do not understand peace.